from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. In July of 2016, two Baton Rouge police officers responded to a report of a man with a gun. Soon, they were wrestling Alton Sterling to the ground. They scuffled, there were gunshots, and Sterling was dead. Protests followed, and the national uproar over the killing of unarmed black men grew more intense. Yesterday, Louisiana State Attorney General Jeff Landry announced he would not prosecute those two Baton Rouge officers.
After a thorough and exhaustive review of the evidence, the facts that can be established beyond a reasonable doubt, the law and jurisprudence of the state of Louisiana and the obligations of prosecutors under the Code of Professional Conduct, the Louisiana Department of Justice cannot proceed with a prosecution of either Officer Lake or Officer Salamone.
And last night in Sacramento, 10 days after police officers shot an unarmed Stephon Clark 20 times and killed him, Mayor Daryl Steinberg tried to talk about the case at a city council meeting, but he was shouted down.
Policy.
And it was
very expensive.
Stephon Clark! Stephon Clark! Stephon Clark!
Anger, outrage, police shootings, and community protests. And the number of fatal shootings by law enforcement is not abating. This hour on Point, how do we stop them? You can join us on air or online. What do you think about the announcement yesterday from Baton Rouge that those two police officers will not face criminal charges? What about the recent shooting in Sacramento? Was deadly force justified? We're at 1-800-423-8255 or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's get a couple of updates. The first from Baton Rouge, and joining me now from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is Grace Toohey. She's a reporter at The Advocate who has been writing about the Alton Sterling case extensively. And it's good to have you, Grace Toohey. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Anthony.
Can you remind us what we know and what so many of us saw in that famous video back in 2016 about the death of Alton Sterling? Remind us what happened.
Sure. So there was a 911 call that came in Baton Rouge that a man had been threatened by another man outside a convenience store with a gun, and two officers responded to that and found Alton Sterling in front of this convenience store. And a ensuing altercation happened, and it ended up, officials say that Alton Sterling was resisting arrest and not following commands, and they ended up wrestling on the ground, the two officers and Alton Sterling, who ended up dying from six shots.
Right, from six shots fired by the officers. There were conflicting reports about whether Alton Sterling was armed. Remind us what we know about that.
Sure. So right after the shooting, a loaded handgun was found in Alton Sterling's pocket, but it never did come out during the altercation.
I see. Okay. So yesterday, Attorney General Jeff Landry, as we just heard, announced that the two police officers will not be prosecuted. We heard a little bit of what he said, but what more did he say? Why will they not be prosecuted, according to the Attorney General?
Sure. According to the Attorney General, he called the officers' actions an attempt to make a lawful arrest with probable cause. He continued to call Alton Sterling's actions resisting arrest and not following commands, and he was pretty defensive of the officers' reactions to that. He did cite two use of force experts that the Department of Justice used as well, and they found that the officers' actions were justified in the shooting. However, they both noted that the tactics were questionable and possibly against police policy or escalated the situation.
Okay, so they won't face prosecution by the Attorney General, but there was a suggestion that the police officers might have used tactics that were not consistent with department policy. Does that mean that officers Blaine Salamone and Howie Lake will face some kind of administrative punishment? What happens to them?
So that's what we're waiting on here in Baton Rouge. The police department here has said they will be having a disciplinary hearing this week, and after that they will be announcing any possible disciplinary action. The mayor has called for one of the officers, Blaine Salamone, who fired the shots, to be fired. But that is up to the police chief what happens to those officers.
Right. And response from Alton Sterling's family? There's a possible lawsuit, or there is a lawsuit. What are we hearing about that?
Sure. There's a civil lawsuit going on right now, and they've been waiting on getting the more documentation. And so they are moving forward with that lawsuit.
Okay. So I'd like to also just get some kind of read from you on what kind of reaction there's been from the local community. Of course, when this shooting happened back in 2016, it was one of those shootings that a lot of people across the country focused on. There were already demonstrations about high numbers of police-involved shootings of unarmed black men. How is the local community reacting to this decision yesterday?
Sure. So actually, a lot of people were expecting this decision from Attorney General Jeff Landry, and there has not been a large response so far. I think a lot of people are actually waiting on the police chief's disciplinary action internally in the department if they're going to fire the officers. And that should be coming by the end of this week. And I think that will be when we really see how the community reacts, because there's been so many calls that these officers cannot go back onto the streets of Baton Rouge.
All right. Well, Grace Toohey, reporter for The Advocate, talking to us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Grace, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And joining me now from Sacramento, California, is Erica Smith. She's an editorial writer and columnist for the Sacramento Bee. Her paper's editorial yesterday was headlined, "Sacramento Made the Right Call to Protect Public Trust," on Stephon Clark. You can link to her at our website, onpointradio.org. And Erica Smith, it's good to have you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anthony.
So a similar story in Sacramento. Police responded to a 911 call of a man breaking car windows. They came into contact with Stephon Clark, who by then was in his grandmother's backyard. Remind us, bring us up to date, what happened.
So it was a couple of Sundays ago. Police had gotten a 911 call about a man who was supposedly breaking into truck windows. And sheriff's deputies were on the scene in a helicopter, and they spotted a man who they said was using a toolbar, which we still don't quite know what that is, who was breaking a back window of somebody's house. The deputies in the air directed police officers on the ground to a man who ended up being Stephon Clark. The sheriff's video started around the time that Stephon was jumping in his neighbor's yard and into his backyard, his grandmother's yard. Police cornered him in his backyard within seconds, told him to put his hands in the air, yelled "gun," and shot him several times. Just to clarify, though, I mean, earlier on it was said that he was shot 20 times. The reality is he was shot at 20 times. So we don't really know how many times he was actually shot at this point, but the autopsy report will come out, I'm sure, in the next couple of weeks. The family has also said that it's going to do an independent autopsy as well.
All right. Well, we've got some audio. This is from a police video that was released by the Sacramento Police Department on Monday of the shooting of Stephon Clark, an unarmed black man who was in his grandmother's backyard. Here's a bit of that audio.
Hey, show me your hands! Stop! 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 Shots fired, subject down. Show me your hands!
See your hands!
By then, of course, Stephon Clark is down. Erica Smith, there have been protests. How is this being handled by Police Chief Daniel Han?
Well, I believe that, yeah, there have been protests pretty much every night in the last week. Protesters shut down the Sacramento Kings game twice, last night being the second time. The police have tried to show restraint, I think. I think that there's been – the protests have been largely peaceful. There's been a scuffle here and there. I think there was one incident earlier late last week where somebody's car window got broken out. The protesters have basically tried to stop commuter rush hour traffic. They've gotten onto Interstate 5, which is a major thoroughfare, into the suburbs a couple of times. But there really hasn't been a huge violent protest. It's been mostly kind of snarling traffic. People seem to understand that there is something bigger, larger going on. And it's actually been somewhat refreshing compared to some of the protests we've seen in other cities.
Now, yesterday we learned that the California Department of Justice will be involved in the investigation. Is that right? And what's the significance of that?
Yes, it is. So Xavier Becerra actually announced on yesterday that his department was going to be overseeing, giving independent oversight to the investigation. His office will not be actually handling the investigation. The Sacramento County District's Attorney's Office will continue to do that, but they will be kind of coming alongside to provide an extra level of checks and balances. I think the significance of that is because there is a great distrust in the community of whatever results are going to come out of this investigation. It'll remains to be seen whether or not, when the results of the investigations come out, if the public believes it, is okay with that. But it's still good. It's still a good step to actually have an extra level of oversight in investigations that haven't had that before, at least in Sacramento County.
And what's, in your mind, sort of one of the big one or two questions that you hope are answered in this investigation? I guess we heard right away questions about why the police turned off their body cameras briefly after the shooting, correct?
Yes. Actually, they didn't turn off their cameras. They turned off the audio.
The audio.
Cameras.
Excuse me. Yes. Right. Thank you for clarifying.
Oh, sure. And so basically there wasn't really much explanation given as to why that happened. I think the police department referred our reporters to guidelines, which is a very broad set of explanations as to why. I also would like to know if Stephen Clark was actually the man they were chasing. There's some question about that as well, given the videos that were put out.
Big questions. All right. Erica Smith, editorial writer and columnist at the Sacramento Bee. Listeners, we're discussing police shootings, protests, and where we go from here. Did you watch the video of Stephon Clark's killing? Did it infuriate you, or raise more questions than answers? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about police-involved fatal shootings and when and if they're justified and why they seem to go on and on. I've been talking to Erica Smith. She's the editorial writer and columnist at the Sacramento Bee about the latest police-involved fatal shooting. And let's listen to a little more tape from this. And I want to warn our listeners, a lot of this tape that we're going to be playing this hour is very disturbing. So after being shot at 20 times, Stephon Clark was left alone without any assistance for about 5 minutes until backup arrived. Here's the sound of the police officers after he was down.
Hey, can you hear us?
Police department, can you hear us?
We need to know if you're okay. We need to get you medics, but we can't go over there to get you help unless we know you don't have the weapon.
Stephon Clark lived with his grandmother, Saquita Thompson. Here she is at a news conference at City Hall on Monday.
They didn't have to kill him like that. They didn't have to shoot him that many times. And the detectives came in and kept telling me, don't go outside or go in the back. I said, well, what happened? I hope y'all didn't kill one of my grandkids because they come to the back door.
And with me, Erica Smith, editorial writer and columnist of the Sacramento Bee. And joining me now from Philadelphia is Nicole Gonzalez von Cleve. She's a professor at the Department of Criminal Justice and the Beasley School of Law at Temple University. And she is author of Crook County, Racism and Injustice in America's Criminal Courts. And thank you for joining us, Nicole Gonzalez von Cleve. It's good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And here in the studio in Boston is Paul Butler. He's a former federal prosecutor who's a law professor at Georgetown University. He's currently a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. His book from last year is entitled Chokehold: Policing Black Men. Thank you, Paul Butler. It's good to have you.
Hey, Anthony. It's great to be here.
I'd like to just start off with a really general question. Here we are again. I'll start with you, Paul Butler. It seems like these numbers are not going down. There's a tally at the Washington Post that the problem continues. The numbers of police shootings aren't going down. I'm just going to read this first line from this Post story. For the third year in a row, police nationwide shot and killed 1,000 people, a grim annual tally that has persisted despite widespread public scrutiny of officers' use of fatal force. What's going on, Paul Butler?
Anthony, I say the system is broke on purpose. So a lot of times we tend to think of the issue as bad apple cops. But whenever there's a investigation of a police department, the United States Department of Justice finds that as policy, the police treat African-American and especially young black men with contempt. They use violence against them. They make arrests and they're prosecuted when white men who've committed the same crime are not prosecuted. So we can talk about bias. Some people want to blame black masculinity. They say if brothers would just pull up their pants, they wouldn't have to worry about being stopped and frisked and shot by the police. But I think we really have to look at the systemic problems. We can talk about reform. You know, there are 18,000 different police departments in the United States, and there's no national standards. There's no minimum requirements. In my book, Chokehold, I talk about a city in Connecticut where, like for many cities, you have to take a test to be a cop. In this district, if you score too high on the test, you're disqualified. They say if you're too smart, you don't make a good cop because you can't follow orders. And so that's just a symptom of how wretched policing has become. Cops think of themselves as warriors, and the targets are young black men.
I want to come to you, Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleve, for a comment as well, just to get us started. Do you agree with Paul Butler more or less on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I wanted to add kind of two words to the mix here. One is this idea of implicit bias, and that is the officers in Sacramento kind of seeing a cell phone as a gun in the hands of a black man, right? That is kind of a cognitive malfunctioning that we can think about how racial bias kind of goes into the fabric of our brain and how it makes decisions and snap judgments. That is one aspect. We also saw it in the Philando Castile case where the quick judgment, right? And he was shot and killed. But then there is this idea of racism intermingling with police culture and even prosecutorial culture, which I talk about in my book, Crook County. And that's the idea of seeing a black man, even a black man in his own backyard visiting grandma, as suspicious and so suspicious that they would literally hunt him and then execute him. And, you know, again, that is kind of a systemic cultural problem, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's the snap judgment of implicit bias in some of these cases, but it's also this kind of culture of racism that's invaded many police departments and gives them that kind of, you know, macho, kind of masculine, you know, toxicity that allows them to treat all black men in this category in kind of a blanket categorization.
I think when we talk about any complicated issues in this country, when we talk about a culture of racism, it's sort of hard to push back against that. But I want to ask you about this one issue. And I've talked to a lot of cops over the years, and I'm always reminded by them, and I'll come to you, Paul Butler, as a former prosecutor on this. They're engaged in dangerous work. They have to make split-second life and death decisions. And so the standard for prosecution, for conviction, is necessarily high because of the dangerous work they're involved in. I mean, can you just talk a little bit about that or respond to that idea? Because I don't want to give the idea that we're sort of making the case that all cops out there are sort of trigger-happy, reckless, crazy guys.
Not at all. I don't think that police officers are any more racist than law professors or faith leaders or anybody else. So, again, I think that when we look at the work that we ask our first responders to do, it's very difficult. And sometimes they're not equipped with the kinds of skills that they need to respond to the kind of crises that make people call 911. Often those involve relationship trauma, people who are in mental health crises, or sometimes even physical health crises. And cops often just don't have the skills to respond adequately to those circumstances. But what we do know is that police officers have this incredible power. They're literally licensed to kill. They have the power to change your life in an instant. And some officers do take race into account with how they use those powers. So there are all these stories of cops taking these heroic methods when they're white suspects not to kill. We can talk about what happened in Colorado with the Planned Parenthood guy a few years ago where, again, there was this literally it was like this very dramatic situation where this guy was shooting all these folks and the police took him in safely. With African-Americans, again, too often, as Nicole said, we just have these people who are going to visit grandma and they end up getting shot by police officers. So there's no way we can disassociate race and class from what the police are doing.
Let's take some calls. Abasi is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Abasi, you're on the air. It's good to have you. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to share 2 points, and I'll make it quick. The first one being that I think it's time to have the conversation and start talking about non-lethal apprehension equipment and techniques. We ask a lot of our first responders. I understand that. And I don't think that it's necessary for a B cop to roll up on someone and their first option being lethal force, no matter who it is. I think that it's definitely at this point time to have that conversation. It's, you know, people are dying for no reason. The other point, and it's more a question, is I wonder why in a time when we're having a lot of conversations about Second Amendment rights, and everyone, you know, not only has the right to out a gun, but it sounds like a lot of people are saying everyone should have a gun. But when it comes to black males, that's not the case. You cannot, without dying, have an encounter with the police, it feels like, with a gun.
Abasi, a couple of really interesting points, and let me put it both to Nicole Gonzalez von Cleve and Paul Butler. Let me come to you first, Nicole. This idea of non-lethal apprehension techniques, what do we know about that? I mean, is that being experimented with? What's your reaction to that, to suggestion
well,
like that?
You know, of course, there's other things on a police officer's belt, right? There's the taser and the nightstick and all these types of things, right? They have a toolkit if you walk around and see these officers, right? But are they trained to use it and think of using it with black men, right? I mean, in the case of Alton Sterling, there are witnesses at the scene. The owner of the convenience store basically talks about the officers being already on top of Alton Sterling, right? They could have used a taser, right? And then we could have Alton Sterling here and discuss whether that was even okay, right? But the idea that he should be shot there, right? And was that shooting him and giving him in some ways the death penalty at the site, is that warranted for what he did? Mm. And I think that the caller makes a great point about, you know, who is allowed to be a lawful gun owner. And I think Philando Castile was in some ways the case study in this. If you watch that video, he says he is a lawful gun owner. He is coaching the police officer in a way that allows the police officer to not feel fear, right? And yet he was still shot at the scene. And there was absolute silence on the part of the NRA. They had the opportunity to speak out and show that they are not racially biased by saying that he was a lawful gun owner that in some ways died for that right. But they never took that opportunity. And in some ways, silence is that language of privilege. And the NRA shows that level of hypocrisy.
Hmm, really interesting. Paul Butler, the idea of non-lethal apprehension techniques, or indeed, another way of training police officers or another kind of police officer that could be brought onto the force to maybe respond to some of these situations in a different way.
Yeah, Anthony. So when we look at the way that some other countries respond, there's a lot less violence by police. So more people get killed by police officers in the United States in a month then get killed by a year by cops in Canada or England or Germany. And when you ask police officers here what's going on, they say, well, there's so many guns everywhere. But again, white guys have way more guns than African Americans, and we don't see them subject to the same kinds of violence. An African American man is 3 times more likely to be killed by police officers than white men. Even the way that we think about a concept like gun violence is race. A lot of people don't know that there's a huge problem with gun violence among white men. So, for example, white men are more likely to die by suicide by gun than African-American men are by homicide by gun. we appropriately think of the issue of suicide as a public health issue. It used to be back in the day, it was actually a criminal issue. People who survived suicide attempts were prosecuted for crimes. Now we get how ridiculous that is. I think we have to start thinking about the problem of gun violence in communities of color, and especially African-American men, as a public health issue as well, not exclusively a criminal issue.
Listeners, we're talking about police-involved fatal shootings and when and if they're justified, why these numbers don't are not going down. This is in the wake of the most recent shooting in Sacramento and what we just heard about the Alton Sterling case from Baton Rouge. Erica Smith out in Sacramento, I want to come back to you and just ask you a little bit about your police chief, Daniel Hahn. He's an African-American. He seems to be bending over backwards, to, from what I'm reading, to communicate that he understands the frustration of the community. Can you just talk a little bit about what he's saying and his approach to this crisis that his city is facing right now?
Yes, Chief Hahn has a lot of credibility in the Sacramento community. A little bit about him. He grew up here. He's African-American. He was hired about 6-7 months ago after another incident where a black man, this one armed with a knife, was shot several times by police officers, and also two officers tried to run this particular man over. There was an outcry within the community, demands for more implicit bias training, de-escalation training like we've been talking about, and also a demand for more lethal weapons and training on that. And so Chief Hahn was hired with the idea of being more of a reformer. He was definitely supported by members of the black community here in Sacramento. And even throughout this time when we're dealing with the shooting of Stephon Clark, he's received a lot of support. People believe he wants to do the right thing. He is definitely keeping up with the communication. He's definitely trying to do all that he can to be as transparent as he can. So I do think that he's doing the right things, and which is nice.
Let's go to John, who's calling from Tampa, Florida.
Hi, Anthony. Great journalism. I just want to offer another perspective. Here in Tampa, I guess about 2 years ago, we lost two police officers. They stopped a car. One officer stopped a car, and it turns out, he called it in, turns out that the guy had a warrant for his arrest, and he called for backup. Two officers then approached the passenger side, and the guy jumped out and shot them both in the head and killed them both. Now, that happened in a matter of seconds. So I think, and of course, Tampa will probably never be the same. I mean, it's just, you know, we're still reeling from that. Both family men. So my point, though, is that anybody who thinks police officers don't talk amongst themselves, you know, across state lines, too, of course. And so my question, I guess, is it the society which is changing, which is demanding these grotesque responses, or is there something racially maybe or something biased with the police or a combination of both? But I just wanted to offer that perspective. It's just such a horror that happened to us here, happened to those two officers here in Tampa. And of course, John, the community is deeply affected.
Of course, John. And Paul Butler, I'll come to you on that. Respond to John. I mean, he's sort of raising the question again that I asked earlier. Sort of not to lose sight of the fact about the risk a police officer takes every time he or she approaches a closed door, for example.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't think as a society we lose sight of the valor and bravery that we expect of our first responders. And evidence of that is that when someone takes the life of a police officer, there's accountability, as there should be. There's transparency. We know exactly the number of police officers who are killed in the line of duty. Thank God that number is going down every year. We don't have that same transparency with the number of citizens who are killed by cops. We know it's way above 1,000, but we don't know more. And there's not accountability. There's not prosecutions. There's not arrests when cops illegally kill African-American people.
And after the break, I want to come back to that very question and ask why so few prosecutions. We're discussing police shootings and what we can or can't do about them. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
When C.C. Wong met his mom's new tenant, he never suspected he'd end up getting replaced as a son, or that his replacement might have sinister motives. This week, Invisibilia looks at the things we don't say to our loved ones and the misunderstandings it can lead to. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about police-involved shootings and protests. You can join the conversation. Why do you think police shootings have not decreased, even after all the protests? What can be done? On Thursday, a day after videos of the shooting of Stephon Clark were released, Daniel Hahn, the Sacramento chief of police, told KRCA what questions he has about the shootings.
Was the law followed? Was the policy followed? Did they follow what they were trained? And then after all that's settled, regardless of where that falls, what can we learn from this and how do we get better and how do we potentially get to where these sort of things don't happen in the future?
I'm talking to Erica Smith, editorial writer and columnist for the Sacramento Bee, who's been following this story. Nicole Gonzalez-Von Cleve is with us, professor of criminal justice at Temple University, and Paul Butler, law professor at Georgetown University, currently a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-423-8255. So let's go to Harrison, who's calling from Oklahoma City. Harrison, you're on the air. Go ahead. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller. I've got 2 points I want to make it real quick. The first thing is I think it's going to continue to happen if you don't have any type of real consequences. I'm in the military, infantry. I've been deployed twice before, and we have rules of engagement. And if you broke those rules of engagement with deadly force and you weren't supposed to, you better believe like you were going to get punished. You were already sent to leave work. You're going to have to do some time. I know a lot of soldiers overseas that have maybe treated, you know, a terrorist harshly and got time in prison, where in America you have police officers that could kill somebody and nothing happens to them. They get set free. You know, so my first point is that there's got to be punishments. But if it doesn't stop to happen and it continues to happen, it's making a huge divide. You know, as a Black American, you know, I'm definitely very conservative. You know, I'm pro-military. I'm pro-police officers. I love police officers. You know, I have a lot of friends that are police officers. But when you have incidents like this, what you have is the Black community is they're starting to be anti-government, anti-police department. They don't want to join the military. They don't want to join the police department. And they look at them as the enemy. You know, so there comes to a point to where, you know, you have everybody here in America with guns. You know, I mean, when is it going to stop?
Harrison, it's two great points, and I really appreciate your perspective, and thank you for putting those points on the table. Paul Butler, I want to come to you on the first part of what Harrison was talking about. Why are there so few prosecutions? I mean, is this a case of prosecutors being reluctant to prosecute white police officers, or is it that the standard needs necessarily to be so high? What's your view on that?
It's both, Anthony. So we can think of police officers killing 1,000 people a year, at least. Again, we don't have the kind of data that we need, but we know it's at least 1,000 people a year. In 15 years, fewer than 100 cops have been prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
And of those cops, fewer than half have been actually convicted of a crime. So part of that is the law gives so much leeway to the cops that technically, if they have reasonable fear that their lives are in danger, then they're allowed to shoot to kill. The way that judges and prosecutors interpret that is that if there's any allegation against a Black man, that he had a cell phone that looked like a gun, that he was acting suspicious, they give the cop the benefit of the doubt. And when the cases are actually brought in places like Baltimore, often jurors or judges refuse to convict. They think even if the cops made a mistake, they were just trying to do their job. And again, that sympathy isn't extended to the typical criminal defendant,
mm-hmm.
right, who often is an African-American man. Black men don't get the benefit of that consideration that police officers do. And so again, there's accountability when African-American men commit crimes. When police officers commit crimes against Black men, no accountability.
Yeah. Erica, out in Sacramento, I want to come to you. It was announced yesterday that the state, and we talked about this earlier in the hour, would be doing an independent investigation into Stephon's killing. Might that increase the possibility of the police facing consequences, as Harrison was talking about?
I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. It kind of remains to be seen whether or not the AG's oversight will actually make a difference, given that his office is not actually doing the investigation itself. It's still the Sacramento County DA that's doing it. But one other thing that happens in California that's a little bit different than the rest of the country is we have one of the strongest Peace Officer Bill of Rights out here. So basically, when it comes to public scrutiny, things like officers' disciplinary records, appraisals, pretty much any information you want off of an officer is basically off limits unless it's declared open by a judge, which creates all sorts of problems when you're talking about tracking bad officers from department to department. Police union contracts also make it extremely difficult to get rid of officers who have committed crimes. So all of these things really feed into a culture that creates public distrust, as one of the callers was saying, and it does make a difference when it comes to how do you prevent these instances in the future.
Let's go back to the phones. Chris is calling from Tampa, Florida. Chris, thank you for calling, and go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My comment comes from a perspective of being a African-American male in America and also being a law enforcement officer here. There are several issues that arise when you're boots on the ground in law enforcement that really can't be quantified when you're in an office or behind a desk just crunching the numbers. Officers face life or death threatening situations, and they are forced to make a decision within a second to a half second that could change their life and the life of the suspect. With that being said, we cannot hold the officer solely responsible for their actions. The majority of what an officer does is reactive to the suspect's actions. When we go to Baton Rouge and we look at Alton Sterling, Officer Lake attempted to use a taser. Alton Sterling was, in fact, armed with a firearm, even though he was a convicted felon and not allowed to have that firearm. When you watch the video, officers gave him verbal commands on the ground to stop resisting. They felt the gun in his pocket. They ordered him not to reach for the gun. Although the gun was never presented, the gun, he never gave up. He never complied with commands. And in that situation, when you know a suspect has a firearm, you then have to make a split-second decision to either risk getting shot or stop the threat.
Chris, I'm going to jump in because I want to ask you a question. I'm glad you called. I'm really glad to have the perspective of a law enforcement officer on this program. But I want to just ask you a question about one of the sort of big points that we've been talking about. Paul Butler mentioned this figure. I'm looking at a Washington Post figure from their database that they've put together, and I appreciate your point that this isn't just about numbers. This is about what's happening on the ground. But police fatally shot 987 people last year, or two dozen more than they killed in 2016. I just want to ask you, as a law enforcement official, what do you think about numbers like that? I mean, does it suggest to you that something else needs to happen, that there is a problem out there that has to be addressed? And I'm not even saying that it's a problem with people like you. I'm just saying a lot of people are dying out there. And is there a way, from a law enforcement person's perspective, that fewer people could be dying?
I'm glad you brought that up, because the problem is not single-faceted. The problem is not only with law enforcement or with law enforcement training. We also have to look at the way society has changed. The respect that law enforcement receives now is much different than the respect that law enforcement received 10, 15, 20 years ago. The access to firearms that our citizens have now is different than the access to firearms that our citizens had 20 years ago or even 15 years ago. The mentality of our nation has changed. And because of that, yes, law enforcement techniques do in fact need to change. However, the problem is multifaceted.
Got it. Chris, thank you so much for calling in, and thank you for the work you do. I really appreciate it. Nicole Gonzalez Von Cleve, respond to what you heard from that law enforcement officer. I mean, reminding us again of sort of what they're facing on the front lines.
Yeah, and I think he brings up valid points. But the case of Alton Sterling, again, you know, officers are the ones trained. It is not citizens and the people they stop that need to coach the law enforcement, right? And so, again, if you see Alton Sterling as a dad or a husband or a person that deserved to live with rights, you may choose to continue with that taser and not draw the gun. The gun was not in sight. There was an accusation of a gun. But again, you know, the witnesses at the scene saw a very different picture. They even saw the three shots fired first, a pause, and then possibly the additional shots fired after, right? Mm. And so this idea of respect for law enforcement, you know, I agree. There may be a possibility of respect for law enforcement going down. But part of it is because we now have technology to expose these abusive powers, make our judgments and see what is happening on the ground in a way that never happened before. Mm. So cases like the Laquan McDonald shooting, where police officers actively covered up shooting that boy 17 times and then tampering with evidence, Chicago was able to see that, and they were able to then hold the police chief accountable and then the prosecutor accountable, right? So one of the things we can think of is officer accountability is essential to public safety, because if the public loses respect for law enforcement, yes, it is more dangerous. And that's why it's incumbent upon good police unions and reformers and police chiefs around the nation to say, you know what, some accountability could actually make our officers safer. They will be well respected. People will comply. What I see is white Americans now taking out their cell phones and actually starting to video police encounters with African American men. And they are starting to realize that in some ways, those men may not be safe. I think, to me, that's a huge cultural change, to have white Americans feel or be seeing officers in the suspicious way because of the prevalence of these issues of misconduct and brutality.
Paul Butler, you were giving me a look that you wanted to jump into this conversation.
Yeah, because like the caller, I'm an African-American man, and I'm a former law enforcement officer. I was a prosecutor for years in the District of Columbia. And I'm very concerned about public safety, including the safety of African-American men on the street. And so that makes me think about the Alton Sterling case. Thank God for videotape, because all you have to do is look at that tape and understand that Mr. Sterling did not have to die. He was presenting no threat. The police didn't even know that he had a gun. So part of it is, again, about training. Every officer should learn in the academy that when you get the rather familiar call that someone has a gun, you don't roll up on that person and voluntarily expose yourself and then use that as an excuse to shoot the person down. You're supposed to conceal yourself and communicate. And that happens all the time with white male suspects who have guns. It rarely happens with African-American suspects. So
I want to I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Paul. Do you want to finish that thought?
No. So again, at the end of the day, the concern is about public safety. You know, it's so ironic to me that I was in Sacramento a couple of weeks ago, and the chief of police, Chief Hahn, actually came to a presentation that I was giving about black men and the police. And he gets it. He, like a number of black men, has had his own bad experiences with the police, even though he's a cop. When he was a teenager, he got arrested for resisting arrest. And so he understands the problem. And I'm really looking to him now to, you know, not just talk the talk, but walk the walk. Hmm. One specific concern is, again, these cops in Sacramento, they muted the volume so that no one could hear what they were saying. That's a crime. Hmm. That's conspiracy to obstruct justice. As an African-American man, I wouldn't feel safe in the streets of Sacramento with those police officers walking the street. So they need to be fired, and then they need to be prosecuted.
I want to get one more call into this before our time runs out. Richard is calling from Detroit. Richard, you're on the air. Go ahead, and thank you for calling.
Hi, Anthony. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead. You're on the air, Richard.
Okay. I have a question and a solution comment. My solution comment is, again, back to the point that there needs to be more punitive measures for messing with evidence. When the body cameras, we find out a lot of times the body cameras are not working. And I think a federal law needs to be passed to say that if your body camera is not on or it clicks off or something like that, that needs to be an automatic, like a 1-year felony. I think that would cut out a lot of the shenanigans. And then I wanted the panelists to respond to this question. If the police of today are simply a historical evolution of the slave patrollers and the slave patrol system, how can the attitude of policing be changed when it originally derived from them hunting down black men and treating them as slaves?
Richard, that last question is a huge one, and I feel like in the minute that we have left, we're not going to be able to take it on as important as it is. I want to sort of stick to this body cam question, which you also asked about. And Erica, let me come to you. We mentioned earlier in the hour that the cops muted their microphones on the body cams after the shooting. What's been the reaction to that so far out there in Sacramento?
I think people are very upset about that. They have a lot of questions as to why that happened, what they were discussing. Right now, it may or may not be against policies and procedures by the department. I think that's going to be determined in the course of the investigation, because there are some instances where officers are allowed to turn off their microphones or their cameras. Whether what was discussed is actually counts as one of those instances, we'll have to kind of wait and see. But I do think it fuels a distrust that is happening right now in the public, and you can see it in the protests, and you can hear people complaining about it.
Paul Butler, in the 10 seconds that remain, the caller also talked about tougher laws, federal laws, on the use of body cams. Good ideas?
Federal laws, yeah, changing police culture, absolutely. President Obama talked about the need for officers to think of themselves not as warriors, but as guardians of the community. That make a huge difference.
All right, Paul Butler, law professor at Georgetown University, thank you for joining us today. Very grateful.
Great to be here.
Nicole Gonzalez-Von Cleve, professor at the Department of Criminal Justice at the Beasley School of Law, Temple University. Thank you, Nicole. It was great having you.
Thank you for having me.
And Erica Smith, editorial writer at the Sacramento Bee. Thank you for your reporting today. Very grateful to you as well.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.